recently, the author of Wait. Frank, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So let's start off with panic, which seems a very good thing to start off with. Panic, as you say, has much to do with our perception of time. You bring up Walter Clark's theory. He's this acting teacher. He says that the best actors are the ones who don't panic. So how much of our waiting has to do with panic or any other sense of emotional paralysis? How much of our anxieties come from this false comprehension of time? If there's this correlation between good acting and not panicking, well, I have to ask, Frank, what's the compromise between being human and being some pretender or some mimic?
Oh, it's a great question. I've learned so much from Walker Clark, who's one of the best acting coaches I've been around. And my daughter takes a lot of acting classes, so I've learned a lot from him. And I think an acting coach, like somebody who's sophisticated watching a play or a performance, can see through a mimic. I mean, you can tell when somebody's a fake when they're performing. And one of the things that panic does is it leads people to speed up their performance so that they run through what the acting coaches call beats.
Yeah.
So it's partly true of acting generally, but it's especially true of comedy, I think. One of the things that I took away from watching him in action was that a lot of comedy really is about pauses and delays.
Yes.
And understanding the audience and being authentic in your understanding of the audience and figuring out exactly how often to pause. You know, we're talking right now. We've just met each other, right? And we're sort of watching each other and having this conversation.
Both and you're of us, a total phony.
Yeah.
Or
sorry.
I'm a total phony. Who knows? Maybe we're both being true. Maybe we're both being phony.
Hopefully we're going to figure it out eventually as we move along.
But I think I can trust you so far.
All right. Okay. Likewise. I'm enjoying it
so
far.
Okay, good.
I'm grabbing my wallet now as we speak, but I do think just when we start having these conversations in our normal lives, even if we're not acting, that there's a role of the pause of the delay, and that just speeding through something 100 miles an hour is not a very effective communication technique. So one of the things I've been interested in for a long time is that I teach law school classes, and my students can't comprehend me if I'm speaking 100 miles an hour. But on the other hand, I can speak pretty quickly and they'll get content down, they'll write. So it's this kind of balance back and forth. And when you panic, you speed up, you speed through the pause. And it's one of the things that I've been playing with as I've done 3 years of research now on the book and wrote it, is how long I can get away with pausing. So I talk a little bit about Jon Stewart as an example. And this extraordinary moment he had in one of his shows where he had captured Sarah Palin questioning some of the Obama military action in Libya and saying she didn't know what to call this. It's just not, we're not at war. What's a word for it? I don't know the word. And then Sarah Palin uses this non-word, squirmish.
Yes.
And for me as a speaker, I would have a hard time waiting, pausing more than a couple of seconds, you know, telling a joke and then delaying. My son, actually, I have an 8-year-old son, he's a lot better at telling a joke and then delaying the punchline. So he'll make up some joke and, you know, what did the two couple of cantaloupe were married, what did they name their daughter? And then he'll do a dramatic pause and say Melanie, mm-hmm. which is just made up. But he'll get a laugh. Where I'm not sure I could do it, but Jon Stewart is able to pause for 20 full seconds. You clock it, and I think that must be some kind of a world record for pauses. And he's just the opposite of panic. He's utterly fearless with the audience, feeling them out, understanding, and being totally authentic, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons we love Jon Stewart so much, is that he's in command of timing and gets us and gets what we want. And goes through this kind of time framework, which I think is actually very valuable in all the decisions that we make, which is a two-step process. The first step is, how long can I wait before taking this action or making this decision? What's the maximum amount of time that I can wait? And then the second step is delaying until that moment. And so in that example, he decided it was going to be 20 seconds, probably not consciously, just because he's a master, and he was able to wait 20 seconds. I could never do that, but...
Well, since you brought up pauses, I think we should talk about them. You observe that the best radio announcers and interviewers use them. Comedians like Jon Stewart, of course. You could even point to the Mike Daisy pauses in This American Life. Oh, am I sort of interfering with the question?
I don't know.
But
beautifully done, masterful.
Actually, though, I do want to bring this up. I could even bring the William Shatner pause into this question. Shatner pause. But I'm wondering if how we react to a pause shares much in common with how we react to, say, a loop. There's this comedy routine, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, Kirsten Schaal is a Horse, where basically it just goes on and repeats and repeats. It's basically this this guy dancing and then clapping and going, Kirsten Schaal is a horse, Kirsten Schaal is a horse. And it goes on and loops for like 15 minutes. There's a Tao Lin poem where he constantly says the line, the next night we ate whale. And there are all sorts of repetitions throughout, you know, art and culture and so forth. Does the manner in which we ascribe authority to a pause have much in common with this loop situation?
That's a fascinating question. Yeah. I think so. I mean, loops come up in all sorts of contexts, and they relate to time in a very fundamental way, right? There's I'll forget the artist, but there's the 24-hour loop exhibit that's out now.
Oh, yeah, Kirsten MacLachlan, yeah, the clock.
It's incredible,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. The clock, where you've got, from various films, depictions of 1201 and 105 and sort of cycling around. And there's something really powerful about the reinforcement of the story. And a lot of jokes get funnier as they're retold. So much so that, you know, even comedians will just sort of, they might not even laugh at the joke, but they'll just respect, wow, that was really funny. And loops come up also in a completely different context I found in my research, which is in the military.
Yes.
So there's a...
Mr. Boyd.
Mr. Boyd, right? John Boyd, probably the greatest fighter pilot in history, who created something called the OODA loop,
yeah.
OODA, for observe, orient, decide, and act. This kind of approach to decision-making started in the military context, but now people use it in all areas of life and business, where you take time initially, you observe, then you orient, you figure out where the enemy is, and then finally you make the decision, and then the decision is the mental part, and then the act is the implementation part. And what John Boyd talks about is running through an OODA loop.
Yeah.
So going through that cycle of observe, orient, decide, and act over and over again, watching the jet fighter you're trying to shoot down to see what that person's proclivities are. Do they like to faint to the left or the right? How fast are they? To understand and to confuse them too, which is also interesting, because I'm not sure whether the art projects or films that we talked about earlier, I'm not sure, they're not really meant to confuse, but in the offensive aspects of the OODA loop, part of what John Boyd is suggesting they do is get a speed advantage to confuse the enemy. And the development of the F-16, he was the person who basically created the idea of the F-16 and pushed its development, the kind of aircraft that's like a knife blade in using a switchblade in a knife fight, that you can use very quickly to confuse and disorient your opponent. So these loops show up. Expertise, if you think about it, where does expertise come from? It comes from a kind of repeated loop, right? Chess players become experts by learning openings and repeating that over and over and over again and seeing certain patterns and chunking, what behavioralists call chunking, being able to, because they've been through these loops so many times, to recognize patterns consistently. So it's a really interesting question. I think to some extent these really deep insights and expertise come out of repeated loops as well.
The OODA loop, since you brought it up, I mean, I have to ask you about that, because you sort of apply it to a number of different things. Like, for example, the lunch dating. And again, this goes back to one of my original question, which is like, well, what is the compromise between being human and being a computer? I mean, not every situation should call for OODA loop. So where is the OODA loop applicable? Is there any scientific backing to sort of suggest that OODA loops are indeed applicable to this issue of waiting and delay and time management and so forth? Because I got the sense, I mean, I think the OODA loop is a really cool idea, but I got the sense that reading your book, we'll throw the OODA loop in there. So, you know, defend yourself, sir.
So one of the things I want to say is that I don't pretend to be able to tell people that particular decisions should take 37 minutes or that you should loop back four times or something like that. The subtitle of the book is The Art and Science of Delay, right? So the idea is really to test concepts that involve timing and time management and thinking about delay and see whether they persuade us in other contexts, rather than to say scientifically. Now, the military has tried to test these. They've done detailed analysis of the implementation of the OODA loop.
Yeah.
They've done lots of case studies where they say that this is optimal in various decision-making contexts. Now,
We're talking about military,
exactly.
Yeah,
so one of the things I thought would be interesting to do is to juxtapose military decision making with dating, and particularly first dates. So
because they are military decisions after all.
They involve some of the same kinds of conflict and sort of bobbing and weaving and mistaken first impressions.
You know, getting a restaurant reservation, absolutely a blitzkrieg attack.
And so one of the things that I did was interview the president of It's Just Lunch, the International Dating Network. This is Irene Lakota, and she doesn't have a military background, but she says many of the same things and uses a lot of the same language that military experts use. She's very skeptical of snap decisions that people who use other dating websites, for example,
You don't even need a dating website to make a snap decision, I'll tell you that much.
That's true. That's true. But if you go on a dating website and you see you're inundated with photos immediately.
Yeah.
And we know from scientists that photos lead us to make all kinds of snap decisions based on our perception of the face, which is we're very good at perceiving faces, but we're often wrong, and sometimes our first impressions will lead us astray and say, oh, I don't want to meet this person. But Irene Lakota's point is that what matters in a relationship is compatibility, are sort of intangible factors, and if you see a photo, you might be led astray. And so she actually will not show, It's Just Lunch has a policy, they will not show their clients photos in advance of a date because they think they'll make bad snap decisions, positively and negatively. Instead, what they want people to do is to show up at the date and do a kind of OODA loop. So this is potentially a friend, potentially an enemy, potentially a mate, but you should circle around each other for an hour during a meal. Don't make any snap judgments. Don't make a decision about the person until the very end.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the date, you decide. And the only thing you're doing at the end of the date, there's some tension that would be analogous to a military dogfight. But basically, all you're trying to do, she says, is decide whether you want to see the person again. Do you want to go out? Answer just one question, wait until the last possible moment, and then say, do you want to go out on a second date?
Yeah. And that's where you really will need the pause. Did you find in your research any practical effects of, say, fast talking like this? I mean, I don't feel any sense of panic just going ahead and talking with you like this. I'm absolutely perfectly in control with this, just to be clear on this.
That's nice.
Well, I repeat a lot of phrases, however, in the articulation of that question, so there you go.
It's great, right? And so one of the amazing things about our hearing is that we can comprehend people speaking about as quickly as they can speak.
Yeah.
But if someone speaks quickly and uses pauses also, then it's much more effective, right? And so there's some common denominator. It also depends on your audience, right? So if your audience is incredibly nervous and, you know, they only have 10 minutes and they're looking at their watches and saying, why is this guy you're interviewing speaking so slowly?
Are you insulting my audience, sir?
Right? I think your audience, I hope this is about the right pace, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
If somebody's sort of talking too quickly, then it's not going to be effective. But if you're speaking too slowly, it's not going to be effective either.
Sure. Okay, I want to actually talk about the Einstelling effect.
Great.
It's this tendency to think in safe and rigid terms when we're given better alternatives. How does the Einstelling effect affect the way that we wait? I mean, you say that there are two ways of countering it, that you could avoid comfortable situations, or you can have different workers who are cross-pollinating within companies. What of non-business applications? I mean, how do we go ahead and counter this? And is there, in fact, perhaps something to be said that is positive, perhaps, about staying in the safe zone?
What a great question. So I was, I discovered this talking to Peter McLeod, a neuroscientist at Oxford University, who did a whole series of experiments on chess players where he set up a board in two very different ways, one of which had a three-move solution to checkmate, the other of which had both a three-move and a five-move solution to checkmate. And the experts knew the five. We wouldn't be able to see any of these moves. They're hugely complicated. Maybe some of your listeners would know them. I have a hard time with them, frankly. But the experts know the five move, which is it's called smothered mate. They know that one cold. So what happens is when they're shown the three move solution to checkmate, a lot of them get it relatively quickly, master level players. When they're shown both the three move and the five move, the five move sort of tried and true thing that they know already, even though it's less efficient, it takes longer, it takes two extra moves, they see the five move and not the three move.
Yeah.
And when he even asks them which squares they're looking at and takes a camera and tests where their eyes are looking, they will say they're looking at the squares on the chessboard that are relevant to the three move checkmate, but they're not. Their eyes are not looking at those spaces. And so what I think it illustrates for us, Einstellung is German for attitude, that we develop a kind of firmness in our views. And it can be good to have a firm, confident view. But I think what's important about the effect is it shows that even at the highest levels of human decision making, these extraordinary master level chess players, we can become stuck in the muck. We can become stuck in our ways and have a hard time getting out of it. The most danger comes from when we're most confident, which is hard for a lot of people to embrace, because once we believe we're right about something, I mean, we really do believe, I know that I'm right about this.
Yeah. Are you?
Oh, maybe I'm not. I don't know. But the kind of intellectual flexibility that goes along with a skepticism of your own expertise, that's a tough thing for a lot of people to embrace. But I think what McLeod's studies suggest is that even at the highest levels of human brain function, that we really ought to have a healthy skepticism about our own expertise, that and that sometimes when we think when we're most firm in our views, that that's the time we should be most questioning our own views.
What do you think would do it, though? Because a lot of people, especially in this economy, when the unemployment rate continues to remain so high, they're going to want to keep their jobs, and they're probably going to be more susceptible to this Einstein effect. You bring up, of course, the infamous European Economic Conference, where people were discussing GDP, and of course Sarkozy is saying, yes, we've got to focus on readjusting the measure of GDP. And of course, the great economic crisis happens then, and of course Sarkozy's out of a job now.
So, right.
So, you know, I mean, that's another case where you have an admirable effort to change long-term definitions that is rendered asunder by a short-term nightmare. And so, you know, are there any real solutions to this? I suppose in the European case, that was possibly just, you know, the nature of politics. You're not going to survive by telling people unpopular things, for example. So, you know, what of this? How do you think that we can readjust human perception so that it actually won't operate in such a rigid, short-term, narrow mode? Any ideas?
Any scientific ideas? The best solution that scientists have found is to, once we understand what our short-term bias might be, to become cognitively aware of it and to think about it as we're exposed to something that might cause the bias. So, for example, we know that being subliminally flashed a fast food logo will cause us to read 20% faster. If we don't realize that we've seen the fast food logo, right? I mean, it's subliminal. It's just a few milliseconds. So these tests don't give us the conscious opportunity to realize we've been manipulated in some way. Sanford DeVoe is a great, really interesting psychology professor at University of Toronto Business School. And he found this effect, and it's even worse than that. Fast food logos cause us to become impatient about music. We think that it lasts longer than it actually is. We can't enjoy looking at beautiful photographs.
Yeah.
And so one thing we can do is just in our personal lives, take pauses, take a breath. Anytime you think you've been exposed to some kind of stimulus, to say, you know what, on my drive to work, I passed some fast food restaurants. I'm not really looking at them, but they're in the corner of my eye, and so when I get to my destination, I need to take a breath, look off into the distance, and try to neutralize it. Becoming cognitively aware of our biases often goes a long way to neutralizing them. There was a study that was done of doctor racism. So one of the things people are often surprised by, because we don't think of doctors as being racist, is that doctors systematically undertreat black patients. Yeah. Hundreds of studies have shown this, and there was a recent study that was done with a large number of doctors that showed exactly this. They showed doctors a scenario with a patient. Half of them saw a white face, half of them saw a black face in the patient, and the doctors systematically undertreated the black patient. However, one of the wrinkles in this study was that a large portion of the doctors who were surveyed, about a quarter of them, figured out that this test was about race, was implicitly getting at whether they have this kind of unconscious cognitive bias about race. And for those doctors, they separately tested whether they systematically underprovided this thrombolytic drug for the cardiac issue that this patient had. And for the doctors who just thought this study was about race, they didn't underprovide the drug. They were able to suppress their implicit, this is all unconscious, which is sort of amazing, right?
Yeah.
That they were able to suppress their implicit biases just by understanding that they might have this problem. So if you're a doctor, you go into to see a patient, if you're aware of that, maybe you won't have as much of this issue. You know, if us in our personal lives, if we know that we have some kind of implicit bias based on race or gender or sexual orientation, if we just take a second even and are cognitively aware of that, then that might go a long way to reducing the disparate treatment of different groups of people.
Yeah. Well, the other DeVoy study that you bring up in this is, of course, the students who felt rich who were under greater time pressure than those who felt poor. So you have two DeVoe studies. They suggest there's some additional element in the background that causes people to rush. You also bring up how multitasking forces us to slow down. I'm wondering, is there any science which suggests, for example, that, like, say, finding another activity while we're in the act of waiting is actually beneficial, perhaps, less stressful than this? I mean, you know, who knows? Who likes to sit around waiting for news? You got to go ahead and do something. So is there any science that shows that sufficient time management that actually takes away this stress is that possible, do you think?
So let me address the first part of your question first. And the second part is really interesting, and I want to get to that. But just so listeners have an idea of what this study was, there were a whole series of studies that DeVoe did of the effects of wealth on your degree of happiness and impatience. And for people out there who are making lots of money, this is not good news.
Yeah.
That the problem is the more money you make, you start to see your time as being more scarce.
Yeah.
And as you apply that to the rest of your life, you become more impatient and have a harder time enjoying leisure. And it's particularly pernicious when people are paid by the hour, as 58% of workers in the economy are. Yeah. One of his studies, he had one group of people who were performing a task and they were told they were being billed out at $9 per hour. Then he had another group of people who were performing the same task. They were told they were being billed out at $90 per hour. The people who were being billed out at a higher rate were much more impatient, were less happy, they had the same problem that the fast food logo flashing had caused. They would read faster, they wouldn't be able to enjoy aesthetics. And what happens is you start to monetize your time and think about your time as being more valuable. So, for, you know, going to a kid's soccer game is going to cost me several hundred dollars, and it's harder to enjoy various aspects of life if you're forced into this different category. So he would manipulate the way in which people would feel wealthy or feel poor by changing the question about, you know, you see these questions where you're asked, what quintile do you fall in terms of how much money you make per year, how much money you have? And people would be asked the question so that they would fall into either the amount of money they have is the same, right? But they would either fall into the really wealthy quintile or the really poor quintile. And again, the same effect occurred. If you feel wealthy, if you were made to feel wealthy, then you feel more time pressure. That's this very counterintuitive effect. And it's for people who are successful, who climb the corporate ladder, who end up making more money, as they make more money, the effect gets worse and worse.
Yeah. That sounds suspiciously against, unfortunately, we have this capitalist system that we live in. We have to make money. We have to pay our bills. We have to pay our rent. I mean, this is largely towards the richer people, but, you know, you're saying that the solution to something like this is just to pay people a flat rate?
Oh, no. I'm not suggesting. Well,
at least the science here in this case.
What are you offering? I don't know. But I think what the science suggests is that we have all these built-in biases and hardwiring. And again, we should be aware of them so that you don't achieve the American dream and then suffer as a result. I teach law school, so I have a lot of lawyer friends and students who are practicing law.
And students who can't get jobs.
And unfortunately, I have a lot of students who can't get jobs.
Yeah.
But even the successful ones are put into this paradox because as they succeed, they start to make more money per hour. And as their hourly rates go up, I watch them become less and less happy and start to make these kinds of trade-offs in their lives where they think about, you know, I'll ask them, would you like to get together to talk or something like that? Would you like to come to an event I'm hosting at the law school? And I can see in their eyes, they're thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to cost me $1,000 to attend this event. I'd rather bill 3 hours. I think it's a really tragic part of the success that people experience that they can't get past that. So one of the things I was hoping to do in Wait is just make people aware of a lot of these kinds of cognitive puzzles and potential downsides where time is involved. I mean, psychologists and behavioral economists and neuroscientists have told us a lot about how we make decisions and why we make decisions and what kinds of decisions are good. They haven't told us a lot about when.
Yeah.
And they haven't focused as much on time. And so one of the goals that I wanted to try to achieve in the book was to try to help people understand more about when and timing and delay and sort of how we're constantly being influenced and pressured by technology and the crush of technology and these influences that really we would be better off avoiding by taking a break, by delaying. It's often labeled procrastinating, and I hate the fact that procrastination has gotten such a bad rap.
Yeah.
Because I love procrastinating. It's one of my favorite. Whenever I can get around to it, I always love to procrastinate, right?
Speaking of procrastination, I should actually ask you to get to the second half of that large question I offered earlier,
right,
which was about, you know, well, if we're sitting around, it's the hurry up and wait problem. You have to go ahead and fill that time doing some other activity or else you're going to go nuts. So is there any science or any kind of studies that you dug up in your 3 years of research which would suggest that perhaps, you know, occupying the mind on some other task is a beneficial solution to the alternative, which is sitting around and getting more nervous and ripping out what you have of your hair? You and I kind of have that same problem. What studies exist to sort of back up, this rather efficient way of staying calm by putting your energies into something else? Anything like that?
Yeah, there are actually a number of those, and it doesn't necessarily matter what you're doing as long as it's occupying your brain. And here's where it works. So, for example, there have been a number of studies of the film Fight Club,
yes,
which contains a lot of subliminal messages, some of which are offensive to some people, sexually explicit.
Yeah.
There are people that might not realize this, but there are topless women in The Rescuers, the Disney movie.
Yes.
There are even more sexually explicit images in Fight Club. And in fact, part of the movie is about how that kind of subliminally flashed image can affect people and affect their behavior. And one of the Fight Club has spawned such a cult of people who are fascinated by it. I mean, it's an amazing film, right?
Yeah.
So there are scientists who wanted to look at what you can do to suppress the potential effect of these subliminal images. And what they found was how busy your brain is a crucial explanation. So if you're watching the movie Fight Club and you're bored or you're gazing off into the distance, you're not occupying your mind with anything, then you're going to be very vulnerable to a sexually explicit subliminally flashed image. If you're occupying your mind with something, it could be that you're really into the plot and you're thinking about the movie, or it could be that you're playing some video game or thinking complex thought.
Yeah.
You're emotionally involved in something else. As long as your brain is active, that works as a kind of shield to keep away or kind of put off to the side these subliminal messages. So the message from scientists is keep your brain active.
So you are actually more susceptible to, say, subliminal marketing or pernicious marketing if you are paying continuous partial attention to something.
I'm sorry I wasn't paying attention to your question.
Yes, I figured you were.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Actually, I wanted to get into the invention of the Post-it, for which you take a slightly different angle. You dwell instead on the fact that the development here was actually a long-term multi-stage process that actually took 12 years, not the sort of instant, hey, we found the adhesive, we stuck it, there was the product, everybody made money, voila. No, it's not quite like that. You say that it was from the fresh eyes from the employees at Minnesota Mining. They were largely responsible for pushing the Post-it forward. So with this example, I'm thinking, well, you know, hey, this is sort of all about compartmentalization. This is, in some sense, I guess, another version of the assembly line idea. So, you know, I'm wondering, how much can we chalk this up to fresh eyes on the Post-it note? How much can we chalk it up to waiting around? How much can we chalk this up to, say, serendipity? I mean, you know, Newton, Archimedes, I can drag out those examples. Those two discovered something by doing something else. You know, how does something develop? Is it really fresh eyes, or is it really just putting the mind in some other state?
I think that to some extent all those matter, but the key one, and I hope that what people take away from this retelling of this almost tired old example of business school studies about the Post-it story, is that it's not an epiphany story. That really the crucial element is time. That it takes a long time for innovation to occur. There are no important inventions or innovations that we use today that didn't take years and years and years to develop. And the Post-it is no different. and it's often told as this sudden insight story, like the apple falling on Newton's head. But an apple didn't fall on Newton's head. Edison didn't suddenly invent the light bulb. Tim Berners-Lee didn't suddenly discover the World Wide Web. Those are myths.
Yeah.
And the Post-it story also is a myth. It even appears in my daughter's sixth grade science book as this epiphany story. And so I thought it was important to kind of set the record straight and to show people that innovation, when it happens, happens very slowly. So Art Fry, as a child, is nurtured. He's allowed to tinker and explore. His school and family help him with that. When he starts at Minnesota Mining, they give him lots of time. They give him 15% free time to do whatever he'd like, even if the product isn't going to, even if product isn't going to come of it. When he comes up with the idea of the sticky note, which is kind of an epiphany at church, he says, "My bookmark keeps falling out. Wouldn't it be great if it would stick to the page?" That's only 5 years into a 12-year process.
Yes.
That's a little bit of an insight, but really what happens after that is continual nurturing from the company. It was called Mother Mining for a good reason. They treated their employees not like employees are often treated today, but as real partners.
Sure.
And people believed in Art Fry, and they gave him license to continue to pursue this product. And then at the end, as you described, the fresh eyes were really important for other people within the company to see, hey, you know what, this could have the following uses, and we could scribble on them. That was an insight that they had that was, it's not just a bookmark. You can write on it as well. And this is one of the most ubiquitous, successful products in history, but it wasn't a sudden, simple idea, a flash of epiphany. It was something that took a long time, that occurred really over at least 12 years.
One last question, because I know you have to split. So I actually wanted to get on thin slicing, a term that was popularized by Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, the idea of being able to sum up a situation in 2 seconds, and it's that 2 second thing that people seem to be obsessed about. It's very much in vogue. It's almost become this reductionist marketing idea in a lot of cases, and Gladwell has, of course, taken it on the lecture circuit. As you point out in your book, thin slicing is never about 2 seconds. John Gottman's snap assessment, his ability to sort of size up a couple in 2 seconds, no, it's actually 2 days, as you point out in the book. So, and even Dr. Phil has used thin slicing to sort of cut through the bull, and it's not exactly the most beneficial effect towards the people he's trying to help. So, you know, what is the proper and scientifically acceptable way to use thin slicing? Why has this idea become such a reductionist catch-all term, and how does it tie into this weighting problem?
Well, it's so much easier just to say it's always 2 seconds, right?
Yeah,
to say
yeah.
that's there's something special about the 2 second period. But the truth is, if you read the studies and the science, it's not about 2 seconds. Even the studies that Malcolm Gladwell cites, even if you just look at the titles of the studies, they're not about 2 seconds.
Yeah.
They're about minutes. And the thing that I think is important to distinguish is this extraordinary ability that human beings have to compress information that we take in a very, very short time period. But often that's much faster than 2 seconds. So if we're looking at each other's faces, we took in information about each other within 100 milliseconds and made instantaneous judgments. Now, they weren't great judgments, but they were pretty good. They came from our ancestry in the wild, you know, out in the savannah 100,000 years ago. It was really valuable to look at an enemy and be able to glean a lot of information within 100 milliseconds. But the thin slicing studies that have been done since Blink have demonstrated over and over again that to get valuable information, it takes a lot longer than 2 seconds.
Yeah.
That you need to wait, depending on the kind of information that you want, much longer, and that thin slicing really needs to become thick slicing.
Yeah.
That you have to slice a minute or 5 minutes. In fact, the leading scholars who write about thin slicing define a thin slice in terms of minutes, not in terms of seconds. So I hope that people will get out of this that there are tremendous things we can do as human beings in thin slicing, that we can get snap reactions and have valuable information come in, but that's not really the end of the story, and that the relevant time period is not 2 seconds, that it's minutes, and that this is really something that's fundamental to being a human being. I mean, what's the difference between a human being and the dog that's on the cover of this book? It's that we can think about the future for a much longer period of time. And although we can thin slice, the thick slicing part is really part of what uniquely makes us human. And so the way I close the book is not with a dog, as maybe I'd led you to believe, but with a question about what word we might use if we have only one word to give to future generations, children who are born 100 years from now, who will be shackled with all of the human apparatus and hardwiring that we have and suffer with, but will live in an unimaginably fast world. If we have just one word to give them, what word of advice would we give them? And of course, that word would be
party. Yeah, it would be party on.
No, I was hoping you'd give me the long pause. I thought maybe you'd get 20 seconds. I was going to give you the opportunity to be John Stewart like with the delay, and you just rushed right through it.
Got into it. We want to get people to read the book to confirm your thoughts, and let's also hope that people actually listen to this whole thing and don't think it's Dick's license. Frank, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
It was great. Thank you so much.
Cool.
Give you a call.